Hello and welcome to the Kunstler Cast. Thanks for listening. My guest this go-round is Derek Jensen, the environmentalist's environmentalist, author of 25 books, including A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe and Endgame, and the new book, of which he is co-author, Bright Green Lies, How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It. We reference a poem in this podcast by Percy Bysshe Shelley. It's called Ozymandias, and I'm going to read it for you. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. The hand that mocked them and the heart that fed, and on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretched far away." And now, without further ado, here I am with Derek Jensen. All right, Derek Jensen, a pleasure to have you back on the old podcast. Your new book, Bright Green Lies, How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It, is pretty clearly a response to the wishful techno-narcissism that preoccupies the thinking class these days. And, of course, that wishful thinking wouldn't be going on if people didn't apprehend the forces that are taking down our way of life. What are some of these forces in your view?
Well, first, before we start, I just want to say that one of the reasons that I love talking with you is because in your first sentence, you used words like techno-narcissism. So, I mean, one of the main things that's going to take this down is you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And we as a culture have been running up against limits for quite a while. And the whole thing with fish is really interesting, that basically they went through the best tasting fish in the ocean and then they moved to the next fish. And there were fish that were considered trash fish before. It's a terrible way to talk about them, and I don't use that language, but that were considered trash fish before that are now considered prime tasting. And that's because this culture has worked its way through all the others.
By the way, I've noticed that in the supermarket where for the last few years they've been marketing sockeye salmon as like primo gourmet salmon. It used to be used for cat food.
Yep. That's what happens when you live on a finite planet and you think you can have infinite growth. And so the main thing that I think is bringing it all down are physical limits. And, you know, we can talk about various other, you know, insanities of the system. But I think that the main one that's actually bringing down this way of life is that it was never going to last. It cannot last physically. And we are in the midst of that.
Well, the oil age was quite an extravaganza, and it induced just a tremendous amount of luxury and comfort and convenience, and that's normal for us.
One of the things I keep thinking of is, and I believe I've got this about right, was the Doobie Brothers album, What Were Once Vices Are Now Habits. And likewise, once luxuries are now absolute necessities. We have become, what is the language they use in divorces?
Hatred.
Yeah, well, there's that one. I was thinking the lifestyle to which you have become accustomed.
Or the lifestyle to which you are no longer going to be accustomed.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things we need to accept. Well, which those in power won't. And most people won't, frankly, either.
Do you think that this apprehension people have is something akin to a divorce, in the sense that circumstances are more or less divorcing us from our familiar comforts and conveniences? And that must be kind of scary to people.
That's a really interesting way to put it. Well, I'm going to go a couple directions with this. One of them is that I often talk about it as being akin to an addiction. I love that the root of the word addiction is the same as the root of the word edict, because back in Roman times, a judge would issue an edict. It means to enslave.
Mm-hmm.
And a judge would issue an edict enslaving someone, addicting someone to another. And there's a great line from the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, might be in the book too, I don't remember, about this one alcoholic says, I used to drink out of the bottle and then the bottle drank out of me.
Wow.
And we're really addicted to this way of living. And unfortunately, you know, usually the cliche about addicts is the addicts only change when they hit bottom. And unfortunately, right now, it's not us that's hitting bottom. It's various species of salmon, insects, you know, everybody else is hitting bottom. And of course, poor humans. And we're trundling along. I was going to say we're trundling along quite fine, but we aren't. But we will insist that we are trundling along quite fine until we are not.
Well, this is kind of a liminal moment, I think, in that whole melodrama where, you know, things superficially seem okay and they're really not, they're very not okay.
Yeah, I don't know how it is where you are, but the town where I live, even before 2008, a lot of storefronts were closed. And since 2008, in the last 10, 12 years, the number of empty storefronts has just gone through the roof, as it were.
On our main street of our 2,500 population former factory village, every store virtually is selling somebody else's old shit.
Right.
You know, the ones that are still there.
Right.
So, yeah, there ain't much. Speaking of techno-narcissism, we have all these ludicrous plans for colonizing other planets that mostly have conditions that are inimical to human life. But we haven't demonstrated any ability to live on this one, which is perfectly suited to us.
That's beautifully put. And is there a question?
Yeah. How do you feel about, Elon Musk's plans to go to Mars and the popular kind of fantasy about it? And also, you know, all of the money and effort and energy that's being directed to that, to ends like that.
Well, my smart aleck response is if it was just him, that would be fine. And then he can go and stay there. but my real response is if I were in charge of the economy, if they made me dictator or something, surprisingly enough, I would not actually crash the system immediately. What I would do is attempt to use the remaining accessible reserves of energy or keep them in the ground, depending on the situation, in order to have some sort of softer landing. Because all of my work really is predicated on one simple idea, which is that this way of life won't last forever. And when it's over, I would prefer that there is more life left rather than less. And also, it's very interesting to me that I'm considered radical, et cetera, but honestly, a lot of my work comes from a fundamental conservatism, by which I don't mean sort of right-wingism at all. I just mean I think it's really, really stupid to wipe out. And salmon have a right to exist for themselves, and they're beautiful and wonderful, and they serve the forest. They're not there for us. But that doesn't alter the fact that I think it's really stupid to wipe out runs of salmon to generate electricity to make beer cans that you're going to throw away. And in fact, I think it's stupid to wipe out salmon for any reason when you may want to eat them tomorrow.
Yeah.
Again, recognizing their use for the forest and their use for themselves. I just think it's remarkably stupid to use energy. And I like sports, don't get me wrong, but I think it's stupid to use energy for retractable stadium roofs when 100 years from now, people will wish that we had used it to... It's like if I was in charge of one of the OPEC countries, like especially Qatar or something, where they make those palm-shaped islands and they make indoor ski slopes, man, I would be putting all of that money into how are we going to live when this oil runs out? What are we going to do? I would be attempting to make it so the habitat is more livable after you no longer have oil. This is a joke, but it's not really a joke, that it makes me wonder about human sentience because this just seems so obvious. Okay, I liken it to if I was given an inheritance of $5 million and I've spent it down, so now I only have $100,000 left, I would try to make that last as long as possible and do what I could in the meantime to make sure that I can attempt to navigate when that money is gone. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, but if you spent all the rest of the money on blow and fentanyl, you wouldn't have the sense left to do that.
Which That's is exactly what we're doing.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, you and I are in many ways on the same page, although I'm not as completely down on the idea of civilization as you are, let's say. I think that our landing is going to be a neo-medieval landing, pretty much, although I could be persuaded that I'm wrong about that. I think you have a tendency to want to take it back a few more millennia.
Honestly, that difference doesn't matter to me at all. Uh-huh. Because we can worry about that when we get to the medieval stage.
Very good point.
Then later on, basically what I want to do is, as this process unfolds, I would like for us to just be as smart about it as we can be. And, you know, there's a story I just love of, oh gosh, back 30 years ago, I was up getting some firewood in the National Forest just from some slash piles, filling up my truck, and I got a flat tire. And I'm way, way out there, and I'm not going to walk all that way. So I'm thumping along on the logging roads a mile an hour, and I get to this guy's house. I stop, and I ask him, do you have a pump I can use to pump up my spare? Oh, I forgot to tell you that my spare, of course, I hadn't checked in years, and the spare was completely flat.
Oh, God.
So can he pump up my – can I use a pump to pump up my spare? And he says, sorry, I don't have one, but I will give you a tire, which is really nice. So he gives me a tire. I drive home, you know, an hour to get home or something, and then get my tire fixed. And the next day, my mom makes him a cake, and I drive back up, give him his tire back, and give him a cake. And he says, thanks so much. You want to come in and have a piece? I say, sure. So we go in his house, and he's got chainsaws all over his wall. I mean, like, instead of paintings, he's got chainsaws. And so I figure out pretty quickly he's a logger. And then we walk out back, or I'm sorry, he says to me, so as long as you're here, I got plenty of firewood out back. You want me to cut you a few lengths and toss them in your truck? I said, sure, that'd be great. So we go out back. He's holding the chainsaw, and he says, by the way, what do you do for a living? And I say, well, I'm a writer. And he says, what do you write? And, of course, loggers and environmentalists are supposed to hate each other. So I'm thinking, oh, crap, science fiction, fantasy, romance. And then I say to him, so I'm really bad at lying. So I say, well, I'm writing a book right now about how the big four timber companies got their land illegally from the public domain. And he starts swearing and turns red in the face. I'm thinking that he's going to kill me with a chainsaw. I'm looking for a break in the fence. And it takes me about 30 seconds to realize he's an independent logger who's been put out of business by Plum Creek. And he hates Plum Creek even more than I do, which I didn't think was possible. Hmm. And the point of the story is, within another 30 seconds, we had our arms wrapped around each other's shoulders, and we're swapping atrocity stories of how much we hate Plum Creek. And then we agree that we're going to work together to take down Plum Creek. And then I say to him, you know, I'm against all industrial logging. So after we take out Plum Creek, Potlatch, Boise Cascade, and Weyerhaeuser, I'm coming after you. And then we just both laughed our asses off. Because we both know that our difference is ultimately theoretical.
Yep.
And so, yeah, you and I can have that argument. In fact, we will have that argument on a post-podcast that is either done in person or we'll send signals by horse or something. Anyway, so we can have that argument when we get there.
All righty. In the meantime, let's talk about alt energy and the wishful thinking that goes behind it. It's pretty obvious that so-called alt energy, you know, especially wind and solar specifically, can't really exist at the high-tech level without fossil fuels to fabricate and maintain the equipment. So how are we putting ourselves on about this, and how can we be so dumb as to not recognize this?
I can't answer the second question. I honestly don't understand it. I understand how somebody who doesn't think about the issues at all, you know, your neighbor, my neighbor, somebody you see at the grocery store, a neurosurgeon, somebody who doesn't think about it, I can see how they would be confused, but I don't understand how anybody who's worked on these issues. But I don't think it's confusion. I think a lot of it is just simply lying. And the reason the book is called Bright Green Lies, and the way it started was a magazine I was writing for, Orion, back 10 years ago, asked me to do a debate with a guy who was a self-described bright green, who believes that technology will solve us and that the problems we face are not functional, but instead can be basically tweaked. And I insisted that this debate be in writing because I knew that what would happen is he would make claims that were outlandish, and I wanted to be able to, he sends it to me in writing and I'm able to then look up and verify or falsify his claims. And if we're doing this on the fly, he can say whatever he wants and I'm not going to have all the facts at my fingertips because you have to actually look up. So I wrote my first section and then he refused to do it that way and insisted we do it on the phone. So then we did it by phone, and sure enough, he just spent the whole time lying. He said things like, right now we could have 100% metals recycling, because I said mining is inherently destructive and destroys groundwater, destroys rivers, etc. And he said we could right now have a system that was based on 100% metals recycling. Well, this never aired because I never agreed to it. And the reason is because when we got off the phone, I spent 15 minutes looking up metals recycling, and I found out, for example, that even though copper is recycled at a really high rate, like 80-90%, the demand is still increasing enough that only, I believe, and I'm making up the numbers, but it's like 35% of copper is recycled. 65% has to be new because of increased demand. And also aluminum, many uses are not recyclable, like it's used in paint, it's used in, and then I sort of fell into this rat hole of they're lying about everything. And one great example of how they lie is you hear them say, the bright greens, the climate activists will say, oh, Munich has promised to go 100% renewable energy. And there's, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 cities, maybe 100 cities in the United States and the Sierra Club have all agreed to go 100% renewable energy. The thing is, that's complete crap, because what they pledged to do is to go 100% renewable electricity. But electricity is 20% of energy. So they'll go, oh my gosh, the other day we had 50% renewable energy. No, you had 10%. And this was on a summer day when the wind's blowing.
Yeah.
And for 1 hour. And then they will go from here to say, this means we can run the entire economy. But it's just, it's nonsense on every level. And again, I don't care if a neurosurgeon or a cricket player or your neighbor or you or me under normal circumstances, I don't care if any of us confuse electricity and energy. But if you've been working on this issue for 30 years and you don't know the difference between electricity and energy, then there's something wrong.
Yeah, that kind of says it all.
So electricity is the stuff that goes through the wires. And energy would include the energy used to drive a car, the energy used to heat your house if you use wood, the boilers, the coal burners that heat big buildings. And then the majority of the so-called renewable energy is biomass anyway, which is either cutting down trees and burning them, or it's growing corn or rutabagas, whatever, and turning that into an alcohol that's burned. And then we have the whole question you brought up of solar photovoltaic cells don't grow on trees. They require this entire infrastructure to build, to maintain, and that requires lots of mining, requires lots of fossil fuels. I want to say one more thing, and then I'll stop this little hyper rant, which is, I talked to Alice Friedman. I interviewed her a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, I know her.
About diesel and about semis. And she pointed out that the energy density of diesel fuel is, I think, 46 or 47, something like that, megajoules per kilogram. It doesn't matter what a megajoule is. It doesn't even matter what a kilogram is. That's just the number is what's important. Mm-hmm. That the energy density for lithium batteries is about 1 megajoule per kilogram. Mm-hmm. So diesel is, I believe, 45, 50 times more dense than, it might even be 54, but anyway, it's about 40 or 45 or 50 times more dense than a lithium battery in terms of how much energy it can store. And so if you have a semi truck with a 60,000 pound payload, it can go 600 miles on a tank of diesel, but to go 600 miles, it would need 55,000 pounds of batteries.
Yeah, that's most of the load of the truck.
That's almost all the load of the truck. So you can carry 5,000 pounds with your 55,000 pounds of batteries. And they don't talk about this stuff.
Right.
And they don't talk about, here's another thing. They talk about all this energy storage, and they talk about building all this, you know, the plans they have for putting in wind and solar, et cetera, have made it so that the biggest threat to habitat, according to their own plans, the biggest threat to habitat, wildlife habitat, over the next 50 years is not urban sprawl. It's not agriculture. It's not mining. It's the expansion of wind and solar. That's actually the greatest threat to habitat. That's how much land they would need in order to do this.
The first of our two sponsors today is Sage Restoration, a fine company based out of Ontario, Canada. They'd like to reach all you listeners out there living in the long emergency who are ready to start building a world made by hand. This company specializes in high-quality traditional varnishes, paints, and other products for building preservation. Peeling paint and rotten wood are modern problems brought on by modern plastic materials, but our building history tells us it doesn't have to be that way. Craftsmen from the past use natural oils and resins to paint and protect wood from the inside out rather than the plastic coatings of today that trap moisture and leave us with a rotten peeling mess. As specialists in traditional wood preservation, Sage Restoration offers a whole new generation of linseed oil finishes for preserving wood and metal that lasts for decades, that do not trap moisture, that do not peel, and that are easy to maintain. At Sage Restoration, it's our mission to restore our connection to traditional materials and knowledge that have been proven over time and work to return the built environment to one that is worth caring about. For more information, visit the website at sagerestoration.com. That's sagerestoration, one word, .com. And listeners to the KunstlerCast get free shipping on their first order. Use the code KUNSTLER at checkout. You can also look for the Sage Restoration sponsorship in the Eyesore of the Month feature on the KunstlerCom website. We thought it would be a nice relief and a helpful alternative to the architectural horrors that we present every month. Well, we've had a very interesting demonstration this week just in Texas of the failures of bright green lies. I think it's going to be one of those really magic moments in culture where people get their heads screwed on a little tighter.
I don't remember the name of the organization, but there's a German physicist organization, which is the second largest organization of physicists in the world, that has argued that in Germany, basically wind and solar can replace no more of the coal or oil plants. And the reason for this is intermittency, that it doesn't matter whether the wind turbines are frozen or there's just no wind. The industrial economy needs, I mean, I don't want to power an industrial economy, but they do. And the industrial economy needs consistent levels, extremely consistent levels of reliable levels of energy. And when there are times, you know, they talk about the German miracle, but there are many, 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 many times through the year in which wind and solar provide zero energy. At night when it's calm, it's going to provide zero.
Mm-hmm.
And your hospital ventilators are not going to turn off during that time. And the Volvo, I don't know if they make Volvo in Germany, but the BMW, I guess, the BMW factories, they probably make those in Mexico at this point. But anyway, the factories are not going to shut down. I mean, I can't believe that with the experience of, with 100 years of experience working with industrial electricity, that they didn't plan for having multiple levels of backup. Actually, no, we're stupid enough that I can understand they didn't have multiple levels of backup. But they should have had multiple levels of backup. That's why they can't get rid of the coal and oil plants because of wind and solar, is because when something like this happens, they still want access to the electricity, which means you have to have these on standby.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the quandary of civilization itself. I think that you've argued that civilization appears to be a kind of self-limiting condition. Now, that doesn't necessarily obviate the things about civilization that are desirable, everything from fine art to root canal. But it does say something about the kind of pulsating nature of cycles in nature, and the fact that things get bigger and grow up, and then they pulsate downward and they vanish. And this is apparently true of the organism called civilization, correct?
Well, I wouldn't call civilization an organism, but we can consider it one. But apart from that, yes, that there have been, I don't know, 20-some civilizations, and they, how did Edward Gibbon put it in Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire? The unceasing round, and I wouldn't agree with all of his terms here, but the unceasing round of valor, greatness, discord, degeneracy, and decay.
Mm-hmm.
And my point here is not his exact terms. My point here is that cyclical nature. I mean, for God's sake, we all read Ozymandias when we were kids.
Yep.
So years ago, Bill McKibben wrote to me, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, he wrote to me and said, I've heard you've been saying bad things about me behind my back, and I would hope that if you're going to say something bad about me behind my back, you'd have the respect for me that you would say it to my face. And I wrote back to him and said, yeah, I actually do respect you. And no, I don't say bad things about you behind your back. I think that you have worked tirelessly and selflessly to raise awareness about global warming, and that's great. Here's my problem. And I said, I've said this publicly, and I'll say it to you too, that my problem is that you say explicitly that what you're trying to do is save this way of life. And I would prefer that you were trying to save birds and bats and the living planet. And because it's this way of life that is consuming the living planet.
Mm-hmm. Very good point.
Thank you. And he wrote back, we wrote back a couple more times, and basically we agreed that sometime we just need to take a walk and have a, you know, 3-hour discussion about this. I mean, that's as far as we took it.
Yeah, well, he'll still be a Methodist minister by the end of the walk, believe me. Well, did I say that?
Well, that's fine. That's fine. I hope that at the end of the walk, he's a Methodist minister who prefers wild birds over this way of life.
Yeah.
So the point, though, is yes, they are cyclical. And, I mean, they usually what wipes out civilizations usually is that the soil is exhausted, mm-hmm. by which I don't mean that in a Oswald Spengler cultural soil sense, but I mean that in a dirt.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah, literally.
One way or another, they can't feed their populations anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. And which is what we started talking about, that it used to be what we gave to cats and now we eat it ourselves. And of course, I mean, I'm sure you and I have both been paying close attention to all the propaganda being put forward about how we should all eat insects.
Yeah.
And
yum.
I don't see how people don't see this as, this is not a problem with eating insects. This is a problem with, I don't see how people don't see this as an inevitable step in the drawdown of expectations.
Paint me a picture of what the decline of our industrial civilization would look like in the most plausible scheme that you could conjure.
Most plausible, not desirable.
Yeah, most plausible.
Oh, most plausible is we're going to continue, we, not you and me, we collectively are going to continue to build mega stadiums and continue to use antibiotics on feedlots and then wonder why there's antibiotic resistance in the world. That cracks me up, by the way. This is a small thing, but it pisses me off that people don't talk about this more, that they say, oh, gosh, you know, maybe you shouldn't take antibiotics for this tiny infection because we want to worry about antibiotic resistance, which is great, important to worry about antibiotics resistance. But if you're going to do this, why don't you stop feeding them wholesale to factory animals in factory? Why don't you not have factory farms? It's just nuts. Human use is pretty trivial compared to to the widespread spreading of it in factory farms. Anyway, so we're going to continue to just do the stuff we do and continue to be surprised when bad things happen. And I think at the end, people will be mad at the earth for betraying us, not at themselves for being so stupid to continue to have these luxuries at the expense of the world, then there will be a collapse that is much more severe than it needs to be. Then after that, the people who are still alive, presuming there are any, are going to hate us with the fury of 1,000 suns.
Yeah. Well, I think that we're going to see this a lot sooner than even you might imagine, because what we're going to see is kind of a pile up of feedbacks upon feedbacks that are going to ramify and destabilize each system that we depend on in a kind of nuclear fission fashion. You know, for example, we're sitting right now on the possible train wreck of the banking system. And once the banking system goes down, all kinds of things stop. I think it beats a path very quickly to famine and all kinds of destructive disorders that will make our version of civilization impossible.
I completely agree with you. And I don't want to get into a whole discussion of COVID, because no matter what we say, somebody's going to get mad at us.
Okay, I agree. Let's stay away from that, because it's just one kind of thing that could happen.
And God knows we don't want even more people mad at us. Anyway, but I do want to say one thing, which is that I got really interested in, you can call it COVID, you can call it lockdown, I don't care. I got interested in the whole thing when one day after they shut down Wuhan, or 2 days, 1 or 2 days after they shut down Wuhan, they shut down a Hyundai factory in Korea.
Mm.
Because they could no longer get parts.
Yeah.
And that really fascinated me, because it doesn't matter why it was locked down. It could have been an earthquake. It could have been a military coup. It could have been COVID. I don't care. The point is, it was a great example of the interdependence of the global economy in a way that is remarkably dangerous, and helps me understand the people who for 100 years have been screaming about what happens when you delocalize your economy and you make your economy mm-hmm. dependent on places far away, especially food systems.
Yeah, and then these broken relationships thunder through the system.
Yep, yep. And they ramify everywhere, so that you have a something in Wuhan, and 2 weeks later, people run out of toilet paper in Crescent City.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, let's talk about one of the other great techno poobahs of our age, Bill Gates, and his plan to, quote, battle climate change by messing with geoengineering the upper atmosphere. What do you make of him and his plan?
You know, this takes us back to Elon Musk, because in both cases, they are remarkably nature-hating. And did none of these people as children ever read the story of Icarus?
Yeah.
Did they never read The Sorcerer's Apprentice or even watch Fantasia?
Yeah. Two great symbolic examples.
I love the line by David Ehrenfeld about how, because we can work minor miracles, we think that means we can work major miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And what he means by that is, it is miraculous that you and I are talking from, what, 2,000 miles away or something?
Yeah.
That's a minor miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And antibiotics are a minor miracle. And, you know, I was reading this thing by C.S. Lewis a couple months ago. I think he's right. He says the modern invention that he would have, this is in the 40s, the modern invention that he would most have missed is anesthetic. And I think I might agree with that. But anyway, you know, those are minor miracles. It's a miracle that you can, I had open heart surgery last year. That's a minor miracle, that you can stop somebody's heart, rip their chest open, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But to understand that because we can do minor miracles, not knowing what the effects are going to be long term, that means that somehow we can manage a forest. And we can't understand all the relationships in a forest. We can't even understand, evidently, that if you put a dam in a river, the fish who swim past the dam aren't going to be able to swim past the dam anymore. We can't even manage that. And so to think that you can decrease the amount of sunlight hitting the earth and there not be effects that you didn't predict. You know, in my book, Myth of Human Supremacy, I give all the arguments for why humans think they're so smart. And I sort of shoot them down. And that's not the real point here. The real point is one of the arguments is that, you know, we've created all these cool gadgets. And then I say, well, I'm going to make a counter argument, which is we are destroying life on the planet, which is the stupidest thing you can do. And then somebody can say, but we made automobiles. I said, yes, that's great, but we're destroying habitat. I mean, we are destroying our own habitat. You know, forget the fish in the oceans for a second. We're making it so things are not going to be congenial for us. And that is as stupid as you can get. So I think that it's very clever. His ideas are clever. And they also show that the danger of instrumental thinking, of engineering thinking, and I say this as somebody with a degree in physics and engineering, that we're really good at figuring out how to build a bridge. We're not so good at figuring out whether that bridge should be made. And sure, somebody can figure out how to dim sunlight coming to the earth, but A, they are never going to predict the outcomes, and B, that's not going to answer. You know, one of the things that I've said for years is if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them, and that unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture. And so we see this, and one of the examples that I used to use a lot, and this is one reference to Hitler that is not SJW and is actually works, is it was said of Hitler by, I don't know, Robert J. Lifton or some other great person who did analyses of the Holocaust. He said, from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. So if you come up with an insane premise, you can then move yourself forward to this monstrous conclusion. And so if you have the insane premise that this way of life is more important than life on Earth, and also the insane premise, and the reason that's insane, by the way, is because without a healthy planet, you don't have any social system whatsoever.
Sure.
So we have our dependent and independent variables switched. And another monstrous or insane premise is the notion that you can do an open-air experiment on the planet and not have unintended consequences. And if you start with those insane premises, then you can very easily lead to your monstrous conclusions that lead to monstrous actions. I think where this culture has been going from the beginning has been, since it believes that it is more important than, it's easier for us to conceptualize the end of life on the planet. There are solid scientists who are talking about the oceans being devoid of fish in 30 years. So it's easier for us to imagine that than it is for us to imagine the end of this way of life. And for God's sake, I mean, again, if I was in charge, I wouldn't collapse things immediately. I would do a slow, you know, the first day, I'd get rid of golf courses and retractable stadium roofs. And, you know, I would save medical stuff, or I would save, what are they called? Unnecessary services. I would save those for the last.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes sense to me, but we're squandering. And that's one of the problems with all the bright green stuff, is they're wasting time we don't have on solutions that not only don't help the planet, but they won't even work for their stated purpose of running civilization.
Hey, everybody. We're proud of our association with David McElvaney's ICA Wealth Management as a sponsor of this podcast. And I recommend you listen to the McElvaney Weekly Commentary, David's fine podcast, out every Tuesday and available at iTunes Podcasts. Gold has been on a roller coaster, but we got a clue about where it's moving later this year. Think money printing from sea to shining sea. Can you spot an inflationary trend? When dollars lose purchasing power, it's time to think about wealth preservation. It's time to think about gold. There is no better asset for building a stable foundation for your portfolio. And vaulted is the easiest way to invest in gold. Vaulted is an online mobile web app for investing in allocated and deliverable physical gold. Buy and secure gold with ease and convenience, giving you full control over securing your financial future. Vaulted delivers the best prices every time, along with personal advising from the experts at McIlvaney ICA. Join thousands of investors who have discovered these benefits for wealth preservation in an increasingly worrisome time. Visit Kunstler.com/vaulted to learn more about the Vaulted program at McIlvaney ICA and earn this podcast a referral point when you sign up. That's Kunstler.com/vaulted, V-A-U-L-T-E-D. And now back to the show. Perhaps you've seen the projection by Deagle.com, which is a mostly a military analysis website, that the population of the USA will be around 100 million or less by 2025. Have you seen that?
Really? No. That seems pretty fast to me.
I'll send it to you.
Okay.
All right. Well, given that, you know, let's wrap it up, because I know you got to go, but let's wrap it up by asking you, what do you suppose we might do to successfully carry on the human project here on this here planet?
You know, I'm a big believer in keeping one's options open, and I'm going to go back to the notion that I think it's really stupid to wipe out salmon when you might want to eat them tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And the second thing that we have to do, I'm going to say the second thing, the first thing, the second thing we have to do is to protect as much wild space as possible, because people are going to need those spaces to eat later. And so protect wildness, protect wild, by which I'm not meaning abstract wildness, I mean protect wild places. And those are reserves from which everything else, including our food stocks, can come. But the first thing that we have to do, I love this thing that my friend Dr. John Osborne, environmentalist and also a doctor, he says proper diagnosis is the first step toward correct treatment. And so long as we don't have the proper diagnosis, we can't make the correct treatment. And if we think the problem is that we are fueling this destructiveness with oil instead of fueling the destructiveness at all, we're going to have solutions that end up not making any sense. So what I would like for people to do first is to, like, look around right now, and how many of the things that you see, like, I see a couch, I see a chair, I see a thing that holds a lamp, I think I see the lamp. How many of those things were on semi-trucks? Where did they come from? Everything around you came from somewhere, and that somewhere was somebody else's home already. So just think about, follow things back in a chain of supply, and then follow things forward in what happens when you're done with them. Oh, I want to tell this story real fast. So this guy was interviewing me. He is a dedicated Marxist who believed that you can have an industrial system based on purely voluntary exchanges. I said, great, do you have cities? He said, yeah. I said, how do you get around in your city? He said, buses. I said, great, what are your buses made of? So again, no exploitation of anybody. I said, great, what are your buses made of? He said, metal. I said, where do you get your metal? He said, mines. I said, great, how do you get people to work in the mines? He said, well, you pay them a whole lot. And we can discuss a Marxist who, anyway, leave that aside. Anyway, he said, you pay them a whole lot. And I said, well, you know, mining is such a miserable existence for the most part that it was one of the first forms of slavery, but I'll give you that one. But what about the fact that every hard rock mine in the world has polluted groundwater? And so what about the people who live next to the mine, next to a river? What do you do with them? He said, you pay them to move. I said, what if they won't move? This is their home. He said, you pay them more. I said, what if their ancestors are there? They've lived there for 5,000 years, and they refuse to move. He said, how many of them are there? I said, I don't know, 500? He said, well, the million people in the city vote, and they vote that the 500 people living next to the river have to be kicked off their land, and then you pay them for being kicked off their land. I said, so what you're saying is that you have moved from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire, land theft from indigenous people, and we can call it genocide, all within less than a minute, so you can have a bus. And my point is, Okay, I don't mean this as an insult at all. I don't think that either your work or my work is particularly cognitively challenging. You and I are not coming up with these weird connections that nobody can see. Do you agree with that?
Are you asking me, Derek?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I think that most of this stuff is self-evident. It's just that sometimes the self-evident flies in the face of, you know, what people want to do.
That's exactly it. It's everything I write and everything you write, I think, is pretty self-evident. And again, that's no insult to you or me. it's one of my jokes. I say it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this out. In fact, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure this out.
Yeah.
I wish that people would just think about our situation, face our predicament, and then start figuring out what to do from there.
Hey, let me ask you one more thing in under a minute. Do you have any idea what the region around Chernobyl is like now, somewhat 20, 30 years after they evacuated all human presence from it?
Yes, it's irradiated, but the wolves are back. Nature is coming back wonderfully. That reminds me of another story. There is, you know, 450 or more dead zones in the ocean. Only one of them is recovered. The one that recovered was in the Black Sea, and it was the worst in the world at the time. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, agriculture was no longer economically feasible along the coast of the Black Sea right there. And within 20 years, the dead zone had recovered enough that they now have a commercial fishery there.
There's a similar story in that book called Cod, about codfish, that came out about 20 years ago, about how surprisingly quickly the Atlantic Ocean fishery recovered during World War II when there was very little commercial fishing out there.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, it's in that book. Well, Derek, I know you got to go, so we'll just wrap it up, and it's been a pleasure talking to you, and we will ride again.
Yeah, let's do this again. This was really fun.